This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Cash Michaels considers himself the Black Associated Press for North Carolina. He's known for offering an African-American perspective on news stories around the state. He currently writes for 6 African-American papers, including papers in Wilmington and Asheville. Before that, he spent almost 30 years writing for the Carolinian, the Black newspaper for Raleigh. And before all of that, Cash's career started on the radio. Came down to North Carolina from his home in Brooklyn, New York, to take a DJ job in Durham. He was thinking he might only stay for a few years, but he's been here ever since. Cash Michaels, a journalist, writer, producer, and director, and joins me now. Welcome back, Cash.
Hey, it's good to be back with you.
Take us back to Brooklyn, New York, late 50s and 60s. Tell us what your childhood was like.
I don't remember the late 50s because that's when I was born, but the 60s I remember because of the Civil Rights Movement. The 60s I remember because there was always a tension in the air. You had folks like Dr. King and others who were on television every day, if not every evening. You had murders and killings here in the South. I was watching from Brooklyn, New York, and in the North, so therefore it was always, what's going on down South with those people? What are they doing? Groups like the Ku Klux Klan and others were notorious. Anytime we had friends of ours who would go to visit family in the South during the summertime, we always were concerned about them. And then when they came back right before school began, they always talked about the girls down here. And so then we wanted to have family down South too. But it was interesting growing up in Brooklyn during that time, and there was always a tension, always something happening. And it was that environment, that atmosphere that got me interested in really media, but news and information.
It was not the gentrified Brooklyn either. You grew up in a neighborhood known as Bedford-Stuyvesant.
In the initial years, my mother was a single mother. She raised me in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Jefferson Avenue, between Reed and Stuyvesant. And then when I attended high school, we moved to the East New York section of Brooklyn by Brookdale Hospital. Anyone who knows that area knows it well. And it was interesting because it was one of those neighborhoods that was in transition from being completely Jewish to then being Caribbean. And so we moved there just as the transition was ending. And it wasn't long before when I went to the neighborhood park or to the store, most of the neighbors were West Indian or Jamaican or the like, very few Jewish.
Difficult neighborhood, and your mother worked very hard to keep you out of trouble, I am told.
Yes, she, my mother, and let me just stay right here. If I'm here for any reason, it's because of the strongest, most devout, most principled human being I've ever known in my life, ever will know in my life, my mother Lillian. And she raised me pretty much on her own, and she inculcated me with values that I still hold to today. So Frank, after the show, I'm sorry we can't go out for a drink because I don't drink hard liquor. I've never taken any legal drug ever. I've never taken, never smoked a cigarette. That was her. She told me when I was a very young child that if you know it's something that is not for you, you don't do it. Because she knew what the streets would do. She's seen it happen to so many other young Black boys. She did not want it to happen to her only son. And so she just told me point blank, you don't want to do it? Don't do it. Tell your friends, I'm sorry, that's not for me. And I followed that advice, and it served me well.
Well, it had to be more than just telling you what to do. I mean, this in order to keep anybody on the straight and narrow, especially as they move into their teen years, that takes a lot of work, it seems to be. What was it she was doing that made you take on board her warnings?
First of all, my mother led by example. She wasn't an easy person to get along with, you know. But you know, when you're Black and you're raising an only child in one of the toughest inner city neighborhoods, ghetto, if you want to coin the phrase, then you have to be tough on your child because it's a matter of survival. But she led by example. She was not a holy roller or anything like that. She was just a strong person, and my mother taught me how to fight. And it's one of the things I wrestle with today. Sometimes I want to fight when I don't have to. and it's something that I really, really, really have to wrestle with. But it was a survival mechanism, and she had to have it. You didn't mess with Miss Lillian if you were someone who was going to cheat her. And she was constantly running into people who were willing to do that. And so I learned by example from her.
But she also wanted to keep you out of the public schools because that's a place where fighting might not be enough.
Back in the old days, the infamous Boys High, they had a saying, you fought your way in the morning and you fought your way out in the afternoon. She didn't want that for her only son. She wanted me to get an education. During the 60s, Frank, and I say this now when I do public speaking, education was the thing that was a banner in the African-American community across this country. The feeling was the way for us to beat racism was to get educated, to put something in this head, develop skills, and then move forward. And so that's what my mother wanted me to do. She wanted me to learn. She taught me how to read, how to write. She taught me the importance of all of that. Sports was downplayed, even though I did play my share of basketball and touch football. And her whole thing is that my only son must survive. And so she drilled into me lessons that, again, have served me well.
Talk about going to parochial school. You must have been one of the few black kids going to that school.
Actually, when I went to Episcopalian school, St. Augustine's Episcopal School in Brooklyn, New York, they moved from Brooklyn to Queens, and so I didn't follow. Then she switched me over to a elementary Catholic school, Our Lady of Good Counsel. But in both cases, they were located in the African-American community. So therefore, you had plenty of black kids who went, plenty of black kids who were Episcopalian, plenty of black kids who were Catholic who went. You know, we wore the uniforms and we did what the priest and in the case of Our Lady of Good Counsel, the nuns told us. And again, that was good structure. And we would hear these horror stories from our friends in the public schools. And we're so glad that our parents would spend the money to have us go to these schools because we knew we were getting an education. And the thing about it, too, is that we got the discipline, too. I can't tell you how many times I was in a class and somebody would cut up and not listen to the teacher. The teacher would call the parents. The parents would leave work, come to the school, and boy, they would grab you by the back, bring you a back collar, bring you out into the hallway, and you would just hear it. You would never see it, but you would hear the kind of fight scenes you could only imagine.
Did you hear it from your friends who were going to public school when you were then got out of school that day? Was there pushback because you were going to a parochial school, a private school?
The only thing they made fun of us for was wearing the uniforms. You know, the sweaters with the emblems or something like that. Yeah. But otherwise, though, as long as we were cool when we got together, they didn't bug you too much about that.
You talked about this being the peak of that portion of the civil rights movement, that portion where we saw activists like Dr. King and others. How sort of top of mind was that to you? Is that something you were thinking about as a young man?
We knew that there were, you know, it's funny thing, you had folks like Dr. King, Malcolm X, later on the Black Panthers. You had various folks like the Young Lords in New York. You had folks who were setting off bombs. So you had the peace movement, the Vietnam War. You had so much activism. The atmosphere was so charged that you could pick your choice as to who you're going to follow. But being able to listen to all of them, being able to pay attention to what they were all talking about and what was important to the African-American community, that was an education that I don't think can ever exist again.
You went to Brooklyn College. What were you going to study?
Went to Brooklyn College. That's a good question. I can't even begin to answer what I was going to study. Mm-hmm. I can tell you what I did study. I wanted to learn how to write better. I wanted to improve my reading skills, my comprehension skills. Mm-hmm. And so those were classes that I gravitated to. Some of the other stuff that they tried to teach me, it was all right. But, you know, Brooklyn College was kind of disappointing. And this is just one part of Brooklyn College. The school that I went to was more of a social club. So kids, students who came, they really didn't attend class. They played bid whisk anyone knows how to play that. It's a card game. They spent all day doing that and earning their living doing that. That was never me. I never believed in doing anything like that. And then when I knew I wanted to get into broadcasting when I went to Brooklyn College. So I went to WBCR on the main campus to join the radio station. The radio station was run by a lot of white kids, and they were into two things. They were into rock, which I was not into. And they were into news and information, had the old AP machine in the corner making noise and so forth. And they gave me this jive time, racist as far as I'm concerned, music test. If I passed this test, I could be on the air. Well, the test was all rock and roll stuff. I knew none of it. They had three questions about jazz because on Sundays they did stuff on jazz. But the news and information stuff, I had experience in, and they like, so they put me in the news department. I was at WBCR when the American embassy was taken over in Tehran. Iraq, I think it was Iran. No, Iran.
The Iranian, yeah.
Iranian
Iran,
thing, yeah. And so I was there with that, and I can, President Carter came to the town, and they were dispatching correspondents from the station to go and cover that and what have you. So that's where I really got my feet wet as far as news and information is concerned. And even though it was a racist situation, it was rewarding and it was fun.
Well, we'll talk about where that led when my conversation with Cash Michaels continues, a journalist, writer, and producer, as well as director. We'll talk more with him on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Cash Michaels, prominent journalist in North Carolina, works primarily for African-American newspapers, but his career started in radio. His first full-time job is what brought him down to Durham from Brooklyn, where he grew up. Well, let's talk about getting into college radio. You got into news. Tell us a little bit more. And you talk about, you know, the fact is that Jimmy Carter's coming through town. Mm-hmm. You're in New York, so a lot of good stuff is passing you by. Did you decide at that point that journalism was it for you? And had you been thinking about it before then?
Really, no. Well, yes and no. Let's put it that way. You see, keep in mind that when I was growing up in New York during those years, the years of Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley, Chet Huntley and David Brinkley. David Brinkley, I believe, a native of Wilmington, North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. Frank Reynolds and ABC News. Max Robinson was one of the first black anchormen on ABC News at nighttime. Peter Jennings and these folks. 60 Minutes. And you know, when you grew up in an atmosphere in New York City, which was the communications capital of the world, you can't help but to be inculcated, to soak this stuff in and say, wow, you know, there's something out there for me. I don't know exactly what it is, but I want to be part of it. I want to be on the radio, too. I want people to listen to me. So therefore, whether it was news or whether it was playing records or announcing or doing commercials, I was into all of it because I had been taught very early on, strangely enough, at Brooklyn College, that you needed to develop all kinds of skills to get your foot in the door. At that time, there was a major move to get African Americans into broadcasting some way, somehow. And they were reaching for as low as 15, 16 or something like that, just to get you in the door. And then from there, you could maneuver any way you wanted to. And that's what I was looking to do. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I was like maybe a year or two younger than who they were actually bringing in. And that really bugged me because I'm ready now. I'm ready now. So being in New York, it wasn't a matter of choosing what to do, but being able to be proficient at everything you did. So this way, then you had an option. And someone would say, hey, kid, I like you. Come here.
When you talked about Brooklyn College, you were disappointed. It was more like a social club than So you left in your sophomore year, right, to get your radio career started. What did you do? Talk about that.
Well, I was, at the time, I was also attending this company. And I deliberately, because I wanted to make sure that I didn't say anything that would be a lot libelous. There was a company at the time called NBS Communications. And they basically what they did, they called themselves a broadcasting school. They really weren't, but that's what they called themselves. And that's where I learned. And what they did was they knew there were a number of small radio stations across the country. that were 24-hour operations, and where from midnight to 6, they really didn't have much going on. And for the most part, most commercial stations from midnight to 6 really don't have a whole lot going on. They're more active than they were then. And so what they would do is they would have people bring people in, amateurs, under the premise that, hey, we'll teach you how to be a DJ. and you couldn't do commercials, but what you could do were public service announcements. They'd give you these scripted things, or they would play canned stuff, recorded stuff. And so you would put these during the breaks of your show, and in the process learn how to do a half-hour show or a 15-minute show, and then they would run these tapes back at said radio station wherever it is in the country. So those of us in the New York area, we tried our darndest to get our shows played back in and around New York. We could not do that because there weren't very many radio stations in New York that had that kind of operation. But they did in New Jersey. So we would get it on a small New Jersey station, and then because of the Hudson River, the signal at nighttime, when everybody, all the major stations, switched their signals someplace else, the signal from the small station would bounce across the river, and we can get it in Brooklyn or New York, and you could hear your show. So here I am at 3 o'clock in the morning listening to a show that I take maybe 3 weeks ago. And judging, you know, what I'm doing. And that's how I developed the skills to be a disc jockey. And then sent out tapes, had a gentleman who was one of my mentors at NBS who trained me to be a disc jockey. His name was Matt Williams. He was from Durham. He always talked about coming back home to Durham and working at the radio station he grew up listening to, WSRC, which is no longer on the air. And one day when I felt that, you know, I'm ready, I contacted Matt after he had left to come back home to Durham, said, hey, Matt, this is Cash. I think I'm ready to be in the business now. And he said, well, there's an opening here. Send a tape down, an audition tape or an air check. And I won't say anything. I won't do anything. I want you to get the job on your own. But I'm good friends with the program director. If he likes your tape, then I'll put the good word in for you then. And that's exactly what happened. And in August of 1981, I was on a Trailways bus from New York to Durham, North Carolina, the home of Andy, Opie, and Aunt B. That's the way I was thinking.
Well, I'm wondering, because it's a long bus ride to Durham, North Carolina from New York. A lot of time to think about what the heck you're doing.
That's right. And got off that bus. I said, my God, they don't have a building here bigger than two stories, you know. But the people, Frank, the people in Durham at the time, white and black, were the nicest. I mean, I'd always heard about Southern hospitality, but the way that I was treated, as you indicated in the opening, I came here for the express purpose of just putting in 3 years at a commercial station and then going back to New York and then working at one of the big radio stations of WBLS with Frankie Crocker or WWRL and so forth. And instead fell in love with North Carolina, fell in love with the people, and decided, no, I'm going to make North Carolina my home. And that's how I got here.
So what were you doing? What was that first job like in radio? Were you doing news?
I worked at WSRC, old AM station. And I did morning drive and an afternoon drive. It was a daytimer. And it was run by a gentleman named Jim Mays. He was a general manager, but he was also the owner. Excuse me. One of the things that Jim Mays will go down in infamy for was that he also had owned WSRC-FM. WSRC-FM was once owned by Duke University. He bought it. Nobody was talking FM radio station at the time, so he bought it for a song and a prayer and pocket change. SRC-FM, later, he sold it, and it got turned into Foxy 107, 104 here in Durham, a major powerhouse as far as black music is concerned. But he once owned it, and all he saw black radio as being was an ATM, a money machine. And it was, because you didn't have really that much competition. We only had one other competing station, which was WDUR, which was a 24-hour black station. And but anyway, though, I came, I worked here. I did a morning drive, afternoon drive. I don't think I ever did news. I was Evangelist Shirley Caesar. She had her Sunday morning program. I was the engineer for that in the morning. I'll never forget one time. And we had a big studio. Like, you see the way I'm facing right now. So you imagine behind that glass, was a huge studio, because they would have bands, gospel groups and stuff to come in, and they would perform, and you'd be here.
Wow.
And what happened was, sometimes I would put something on while they're performing and talking, and then she'd call for me to play a record or something, and then I wouldn't hear it, and then she said, look alive in there now, you know, she said on the air and what have you. And it was really, it was a great experience, though, and I stayed there, I think, about 3 years, if I'm not mistaken.
And is that where you moved into the role of program director there? Was that
after, before I left, I became the program director, yeah.
Yeah, and so now you're getting some management experience. You left that station in 83, and you left broadcasting for a little while. Did you?
I did insurance at the time. Yeah. Did A.O. Williams Insurance. And then a friend of mine who worked at WDUR, he asked if I would come over to WLLE in Raleigh. He had just become program director, and asked if I would be his morning man there. And that's how I got back into radio, working in Raleigh. And I'll never forget when the general manager hired me there. He said, now, I'm not sure if people here in Raleigh want to hear you. And I said, why? And I was replacing a very popular morning personality who they had just fired. He said, well, you have to understand the dynamic here between Raleigh and Durham. In Durham, you have a lot of people who have jobs. He's talking about black people in particular. In Durham, you have people who have jobs that they are dirty, high-paying jobs. He was referring to tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Raleigh, we have a lot of black people who have clean, low-paying jobs, talking about government.
Mm-hmm.
and he was saying, there's a difference between the two communities, and I don't think you know that, too. And plus, you're from New York, too, so, boy, tell you what we're going to do. We'll give you a probation period. We'll put you on the air for a week or two. I'm going to drive around the community and ask people what they think of you. And if they like you, then you have a job. If you don't, I'm sorry. And that's the way I got the job at WLLE. And I promised myself that I would not wait a week, that I would do the best I could. And I said, if they don't get it that I'm the best thing that they've had in 2 days, then I'll leave. I won't wait for them to fire me.
You were also very active in the community, even with that first job. You liked getting out. Was he right? Was there a distinction? Interesting observation to make, and I wonder if it was true and what you make of that.
Well, it was true, because at the time, if you were in tobacco, you made good money.
Yeah.
Tobacco's not as prominent now, obviously. But at the time, 1981, if you worked in tobacco, yeah, you had a dirty, stinky job, but you made money. Lots of black folks here bought homes and so forth. Mm. And Raleigh, which is the hub of state government,
right.
You had a lot of folks who got jobs based on patronage and who knows who and who's close to what white politician and so forth. And so they prided themselves, you know, being dressed in the nice suits and this and that, you know. And they weren't getting any money, really,
right.
You know. But that was the currency. Politics was and still is the currency in Raleigh.
Obviously, you can make that distinction. You can look at the jobs and say, well, here's what they're doing, and most people are doing that. But is there a distinction? Could you feel the cultural difference?
Yeah.
Yeah,
because up until that point, I lived in Durham.
Yeah.
So I knew Durham pretty well. I spent 3 years in Durham, so I pretty much knew the people in Durham, and knew what was important. And Raleigh, I didn't know, but I was feeling it right away that there was a special pride. There was a special something about those folks that was different from Durham. Not better, just different. And I needed to get acclimated to that really quick.
Now, the owner of that station also owned the Carolinian.
Right. Right.
Is that how you got into newspapers?
Yeah, what happened was, I think it was 1991. Well, I started writing part-time for the paper just to maintain my writing skills. And 1991 came, they fired their editor. He apparently thought that news coverage was a matter of sitting at your desk, pulling out the News and Observer, rewriting all the stories, and then putting your name to it, and then handing it in and then going home. And they said, no, that's got to stop. And so they hired me temporarily to become the editor of the Carolinian. And then after a while, I just stayed there and just did the job.
What about, I would break out here and pause in this discussion about your trajectory to talk about the importance of black newspapers to you. Were you reading the black press up until then? And generally speaking, the importance of the black press to African-American communities.
Yeah, the Carolina Times here in Durham is an institution, Lewis Austin, the publisher and founder. And so I was very much up on the importance of the black press, but not so much as to when I actually started working for the black newspaper and realized that outside of the black church, you really didn't have another institution in the mm-hmm. black community that people could trust or should trust, at least, to be their voice, to give perspective to the overall happenings of what was going on in their community, their county, their state, their country. I recognized that when African Americans had problems with government, the black press was something that they turned to because mm-hmm. they really had, the black press and the church. But in terms of having an actual voice, speaking truth to power, that's what black newspapers were built on. They had a heritage, a legacy, and they were founded by very courageous people who, because they were speaking against power, white power, white supremacy for that matter, mm-hmm. they were always under threat. Advertisers would always try to bankrupt them, things of that nature. So the Carolinian had a good, strong reputation, and I felt I could bring something to the table. When we had the big fight here about establishing the King holiday, and a lot of people listening now probably won't remember this, but that was a huge deal. There were a lot of folks who did not want this state to offer a paid holiday, a state paid holiday mm-hmm. to state employees. They did not want that. And they tried to come up with every, including the governor, Governor Jim Martin at the time, a Republican, who said, you know, Dr. King, he didn't want more days off. He wanted days on. Yeah, right. You know, and, mm-hmm. and so, you know, your black newspaper was the one in the forefront, you know, saying this state needs to honor Dr. King like the rest of the country does. And that's where you cut your teeth. When you have issues like that right. come forward and you want to present to the community, you want to rally the community, you want to cut through all the nonsense and BS and let folks know this is the issue and we're on your side with it. And that was tremendously instructive for me.
Given the special significance of the black press in those communities, in African-American communities, and the role that it's played, is the black press enduring some of the same, I would say, some of the same grief as the rest of the press nationally and what we're seeing in newspapers around the country?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because we've always endured it. These folks are playing catch up to what we've been going through for the longest. I mean, it really, you know, yeah. we are always, and it's unfortunate but true, we are always in a survival mode. We are always in, can we make payroll this week? We are always in a, can we pay the light bill this week? We are always in, can we pay the newsprint bill this week? It's always a struggle with advertisers. We cherish our advertisers, but most of our advertisers are, quite frankly, white businesses trying to reach the African-American community. You know, we're always trying to build the black community, or I should say the black economy in our community, so this way then we can hire more of our people mm-hmm. in order to have more jobs and more opportunity. And so it's always been a struggle. We were forced after USA Today came out, you may recall, and they were the first color news right. publication on the stands. They would do it by satellite. That forced everybody, News and Observer, Durham Herald at the time, and small black community newspapers to go color. That was an expense that we had to deal with. We've had to do so many things because the market demanded it. But it helped us grow, it helped us learn. One of the problems that we've always had, and I think we still have too, is getting young people in particular, younger readers, to embrace black newspapers for the express purpose of replacing our most loyal readers who are dying off and have been so for the longest time. And so figuring out a way to get young people to pick up a hard copy black newspaper and to know that we serve them too, that's been extremely difficult. Going online was a big challenge. You know, it was a big challenge for major market newspapers. It's been a challenge for us too. I mean, we're online, but being able to monetize that is something that is a challenge even today.
Yeah, but let me ask you, is it that important? I mean, I understand the legacy and the important role that those papers have played, but is it being replaced by social media? We see the Me Too movement. We see, the Black Lives Matter. Those are hashtag movements, right?
Right.
So maybe they've been replaced. Is social media the new black press?
Well, I've heard suggestions that television news has been replaced by social media. To a certain extent, that's true. What we in the news business have to do, and I'm not just speaking for the black press, is make it clear to our readers, our audience, that, with professional news media, we have standards. We have gatekeepers, folks who pay attention to what is news, what isn't news. We have a mission. We have an agenda, but the agenda isn't one that's political per se, though it's hard to tell it with something in some cases, but rather to make sure that you're getting solid information that you can use. That's not the case on social media, where anybody and everybody can empower themselves to go online and say anything they want. So given your movements, our job is to, okay, Me Too, what is this about, and how does it serve us, or does it? Mm-hmm. And it's when you ask the pertinent questions, that's what our readers and our listeners, that's what they depend on us for. You've been here long enough to know how to do this job. Are you still doing it at the optimum standard that we expect?
We're going to ask some more questions of Cash Michaels, journalist, writer, producer, and director. That conversation continues on The State of Things in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Cash Michaels today. Covers news around the state for 6 African-American newspapers, including papers in Wilmington and Asheville. Also a film producer and director. First feature-length film came out in 2010 called Obama in NC, The Path to History. So tell us about how you got involved in filmmaking.
I had been, as I said before, coming up in New York, I wanted to be a communicator. And I wasn't particularly keen on, okay, I just want to be a disc jockey because I just wanted to write news, or I just wanted to do it. It was like all of it. Yeah. All of it fascinated me. Every time I turned on a TV or saw an interview on 60 Minutes or something like that, it was like I would see somebody there and I would, it was like Spike Lee or somebody, and I would go like, yeah, I could do that. I think I can do that or whatever. So had been here for a couple of years, and actually, to be, now that I think about it, back in Brooklyn, I think my mother had an old Bell and Howell 8mm camera. You remember Bell and Howell, mm-hmm. right? I don't even know if they're still in business. And I used to dally with that and do things mm-hmm. and so forth. I worked at St. Augustine's College, now University, for a while, and then when they worked at the radio station and also the TV station briefly, and they allowed their video equipment to be taken out and would do things over there and what have you, and enjoyed it. So finally, and then of course, taking pictures for the newspaper. So I'm a very visual person, and when I one of the things that I cherish a great deal is good storytelling. I love good storytelling. Don Hewitt, the founder of 60 Minutes, his edict to all of his reporters, Mike Wallace and the guy with the checkered shirts and the weird ties, who died recently. I've got his name, Morley Safer. Great journalist, mm-hmm. but he always told them, if you pitch me a story, tell me a story. Right. And I always found that to be powerful. You know, simple but powerful. And so that's what I wanted to do, be able to tell stories with to people. And in 2008, obviously the most miraculous thing happened politically, which was namely a black man, a skinny guy with big ears and a weird name from Chicago, wanted to be president of the United States. And, oh, please, you know. But the more you saw of this young man, the more you became fascinated. And the more that you saw him get around the country and speak and capture people's imagination as to what this country could be. And then you find out he's coming to North Carolina. Indeed, he has to come to North Carolina if he wants to be president of the United States. Then I said, well, when he does come, let me get a camera and do the best I can to follow him around. And so I did, and then once Barack Obama was elected, I said, I've got all this video. And at first I was going to do something, and come to find out that HBO had actually done something better. They had a, they had a crew actually follow Obama around during the primaries. I said, well, I can't do the same thing. I'm not going to do the same thing. But then I came up with the concept of, let me just focus on what he did in North Carolina, because his win over Hillary Clinton in the primaries in 2008, that was consequential. If he did not win the primary here against her, he would not have become president. That's plain fact. And so that gave me something to build around. And that allowed me to do a film, do a story on North Carolina's racial history, because Obama would be only the second Democrat since, I think Jimmy Carter, or was it Bill Clinton? I think it was Jimmy Carter, who won North Carolina in a primary. And I said, given that piece of history, build a story around that, and then also make it a personal history. Because, see, my mother died the day before he was inaugurated. So, therefore, work that story in, too, and therefore really build an entire story around him coming to North Carolina and winning the primary. And so that's what that film is about. It's actually three stories in one.
Well, let's hear a clip from that film. This is Obama in North Carolina, The Path to History.
I think the Lord rigged that election. Classical political science would not give you a North Carolina victory for a black man.
That's a clip from the trailer of Cash Michael's 2010 film Obama in North Carolina, The Path to History. I'm talking to Cash Michael's now. What do you think did account for that? You did take a look at it. Not only does he win the primary over Hillary Clinton, but also the state, and became the southernmost state in the country to vote for, to give its electoral votes to a black man in 2008.
Obama brought an energy that I don't think we'll ever see again. I'm sorry. I understand there are 200 people running for the Democratic nomination.
250 now today. That was just an hour.
But I'm sorry, none of them measure up. And they know that, quite frankly. Mm. They've all been to the throne and have kneeled and asked him, okay, you know, please tell us, Godfather, how we can do this thing. He brought in energy. It was a freshness. It was something that, and to be frank about it was something that was history, and it was something that, quite frankly, a lot of black people, older black people, thought they would never see in their lifetimes. And here it was, they were living while it was happening. There were a lot of people who were afraid for his life, and justifiably so. But he brought in energy. My eldest daughter, Tiffany, she wasn't interested in politics whatsoever. But the moment Obama came along, she invested and voted and all like that. You know, that's the magic that he brought. And also, you have to give credit where credit's due to the Reverend William Barber, who was president of the NAACP at the time. He and the North Carolina NAACP lobbied hard for same-day registration, one-stop early voting. That was something that he lobbied very hard, not for Obama. In fact, it actually started before Obama began running, but because he felt it was the right thing, and it has proven to be the right thing. In fact, so much so the Republicans have been trying their best to kill to kill it,
and actually had to break the law in order to be successful, at least according to the courts.
You know, so I mean, you know, that was a piece of history that I think that we may never see again, but we certainly, it was certainly something that lifted all of us, and something per North Carolina that I was very proud to make a film about.
You know, it's interesting because the question is, I mean, Barack Obama did that for the entire nation. In other words, he brought that energy everywhere. The state of North Carolina is fascinating. You talked about the fact that if he hadn't won the primary here, he doesn't become president. It's interesting to think about the paradox, because if you think back to the 1976 primary, right? One Senator Jesse Helms encourages a fellow by the name of Ronald Reagan after he had just lost the Michigan primary and was about to drop out of the race in 76. And that would have been the end of Ronald Reagan's career. Mm-hmm. Jesse Helms says, no, I've got this guy here, Richard Viguerie. He does these direct mail campaigns. I'll explain it to you in a minute, but I think it might help you. Mm-hmm. Stay for just one more. He does. He wins the North Carolina primary in 76, doesn't get the nomination, but comes back in 1980. And here we are. So, I mean, it's fascinating to think about this being the state that can go both ways in some way, a pivotal state, but a state that is always engaged politically and is always pivotal in American politics.
Let me tell you, leaving Brooklyn and coming to North Carolina to start a career, without a doubt has defined my life. I mean, that's a given. I mean, that mm-hmm. is why I'm here to begin. You and I would never have met if it didn't happen. But I've being a New Yorker and watching the growth of North Carolina economically, politically, socially, over these years, coming from a perspective of not being a native here. And I think many people who have done the same thing, come from someplace else and have been here for a period of time, would agree. It has been fascinating, to say the least.
Talk about another pivotal place, and a place that has certainly played an important part in American history, was the city of Wilmington, North Carolina. You made a film that looks at the state's history. We did it in 2014, but you were focused on the Wilmington 10, Pardons of Innocence, the Wilmington 10. Tell us more about that film.
Well, you know, in 2011, the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is an association of some 200 African-American newspapers across the country, voted to seek pardons for the Wilmington 10. They felt that some 40 years had passed, and the state of North Carolina had never pardoned them, even though they were never proven to have committed the crimes they were convicted of in 1972, I believe. The publisher of the Wilmington Journal, Ms. Mary Alice Thatch, who is still my boss today, she took on the role of seeking pardons, and asked me to come aboard as coordinator of the project to do that. To make a long story short, we did it. We were able to achieve pardons of innocence, actually, from then-Governor Beverly Perdue. And I'm here to tell you now, if it wasn't for Beverly Perdue, it would never have happened. Mm. No other governor, Republican or Democrat, wanted to touch it. But she did. And to this day, I thank her. Governor Perdue, if you're listening, I thank you. You know I love you. And so it made, again, one of those situations where I was deeply involved, where I had a video camera with me more times than not. What do you do with all of this history? Well, you make a film out of mm-hmm. it. And that's what I did. And it's a film I'm extremely proud of, because not only did it deal with the effort to achieve pardons of innocence, but also the racial history of Wilmington, North Carolina, the 1898 race massacre there, right, which is part of history and what have you, and then showing how if that had never happened, there never would have been a Wilmington 10. I'm very proud of that film.
Well, let's play a couple of clips from that film as well.
If you live in Wilmington and you just have that daily experience of knowing when you're in the white community, the roads will be paved, when you're in the black community, the roads aren't paved, when you look at the boards at the time and all the political groups, even though there are an awful lot of black people in Wilmington, all of the faces on the boards and the officials are white, then you get an idea of what these students weren't fighting a frivolous battle, if that makes sense to you. I mean, it's not so much something you hear about, it's something you live and you see. And it's not racism as somebody using the N-word. Racism is somebody using the structures of the town to make sure that a group of people never has a fair chance.
The beginning point of the saga of the Wilmington 10, you have to go back to the race massacre in Wilmington, North Carolina, in November of 1898. And from 1898 to 1971, the black community of Wilmington, North Carolina, had been continuously engaged in struggling for self-determination, the right for to get a good education, and struggling for economic development, and struggling for political empowerment. This was a constant struggle. It was about school desegregation. It was about challenging white supremacy, which was an ideology that had been institutionalized not just in school systems, but in the mindset of people.
That's a clip from the 2014 film Pardons of Innocence, The Wilmington 10. My guest is the film's producer and director, journalist Cash Michaels. And I guess the important thing there is, I mean, there's lots of controversy around the Wilmington 10, whether or not they were framed and set up and all of that. But really,
yes, they were. Simple as that. Let me cut to the quick. Yes, they were.
And there was a lot of violence, and the only people who were arrested for any of it were African Americans.
Right.
But the most important thing, it seems to me, when there's a miscarriage of justice and people are falsely accused, that's one thing and very important to point out. But these other systemic issues that go back to 1898 that have never been properly talked about for a century, I mean, the fact that everybody can ignore the issue of only black people being indicted when so much violence is taking place,
well, you know,
those are systemic.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we're going through as a state right now at UNC Chapel Hill, in Carrboro in particular, other areas in and around the Capitol, are monuments that have been put up commemorating and indeed celebrating white supremacists of the past, buildings that have been public buildings that have been named after known white supremacists, and how now there's this movement to change that. In Wilmington, they have it worse. They have monuments and buildings, whatever else, that have been named after white supremacists who were leaders in the 1898 race massacre. And a lot of folks don't like that. A lot of these folks are being held up as great examples of being American and this and so forth and so on. And the folks, black folks in Wilmington in particular, they're not having it. You know, they're like, no, wait a minute, read about this person and know what they did. A lot of property in Wilmington was taken by force during the 1898 massacre. And a lot of these folks that they built monuments to and the like were responsible for that, have never given the property back to the respective families, have made millions off of this property and the like. And folks are still trying to parse all that out.
Are we making any progress, though, the fact that we are debating these monuments? I mean, as I think somebody pointed out, there's not a county in this state that doesn't have a building or something named after Charles Aycock, one of the architects of that massacre and coup d'etat for which he was never punished.
Right.
But are we making progress? Are things turning around, do you think, the fact that we're debating this, the fact that monuments are coming down?
I think we are. Obviously, there are different levels of discussion, to say the least. But I think that that we are. The whole situation with Silent Sam, for instance, is something that is quite major, something that's being watched nationally. It has cost UNC Chapel Hill its chancellor. But nonetheless, there is pressure being brought to bear. I think that is a good thing, because the one thing that this country refuses to do, let alone the state of North Carolina, is to have an honest discussion about race. That is something that we have never done. We are afraid to do it because we don't like the answers. We know what the answers are, but no one wants to be responsible for bringing them to the fore. And because then once you do that, that means then that people are going to be held accountable and there's going to be ownership of that history. And nobody wants that.
Cash Michaels, journalist, writer, producer, director. We'll look forward to more to come from Cash Michaels. Thank you so much for sharing this.
I look for part two.
2018 film, Al, My Brother, by the way. We didn't even get to that one, but we did talk about that one just a few months ago. Al, My Brother. That is going to be screening Thursday night at the Carolina Civic Center in Lumberton. And you can check our website, stateofthings.org, for all of the information on that. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnuson, Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.